From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with author, editor, translator, and educator Wendy Call, whose current literary projects include a series of essays on grief and loss, a craft book about sense of place on the page, and translations of Mexican and Colombian poetry by indigenous women. She has served as writer-in-residence at 20 institutions, including universities, national parks, high schools, visual art centers, a historical archive, and a public hospital. She co-edited Telling True Stories, a nonfiction writer's guide. Her book, No Word for Welcome, The Mexican Village Faces the Global Economy, won Grub Street's National Book Prize for Nonfiction. And in 2015, Wendy Call was a National Endowment for the Arts Fellow in Translation. As I said, we spoke in 2014. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I first wanted to just ask what languages you work with in your translation work. Is it mainly English, Spanish, and Zapotec, or are there other languages that you also work with?
Right now, it's just those, and it's a little bit of a stretch to say that I work with Zapotec since I do not, you know, read, speak, or understand Zapotec. I work, you know, with poets that's their native language, and then they translate into Spanish, and then I translate into English.
Okay.
But I do work with them on the Zapotec original version of the poem, not just the Spanish versions of the poems. And there are other poets who I'm in touch with. I've written about some of their work in other contexts, but I haven't actually translated it yet. And those languages are Mixtec and Zoque and Tzotzil, which are all other southern Mexican languages. So I'm sort of working my way up to translating from some other native Mexican languages. But even though I did not learn Zapotec, I learned enough about Zapotec culture and a little bit about the language itself that it feels like a lot of work to start adding more languages.
Yeah.
But I am hoping to do that.
Now, when you say southern Mexico, is the isthmus considered southern Mexico?
Yes.
And so these are languages of the isthmus, correct?
Well, Zapotec and Zoque are.
Okay.
Mixtec is spoken in other parts of the state of Oaxaca. The isthmus is a really tiny geographic area, and there are, depending on how you count languages, there are about 8 to 10 native languages that are spoken there.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones that sort of have large local literatures that I'm in touch with the writers that work in those languages, Zapotec and Zoque, are the only ones that are actually from the isthmus region. And Tzotzil is one of the major languages of Chiapas, which is the state, you know, right next door to Oaxaca, where the isthmus is.
Okay. All right. Great. Now, I know that one of the articles that you sent me a link to talked a little bit about Zapotec, and there was the mention of the fact that three distinct languages are actually called Zapotec. So are any of these other ones that you're mentioning right now, are any of those the ones that are also called Zapotec, or are we?
No, actually, our understanding of these languages, I think, keeps becoming more complex. And now, actually, linguists talk about how there are four language families within Zapotec, all of which are called Zapotec, but there's Sierra Norte, Sierra Sur, Valley, and Isthmus, which is essentially explaining the four regions where they're primarily spoken in southern Mexico. But there are still more than four different versions of the language that, let's say, you know, the poet whom I've worked with the most, Irma Pineda, if she were to speak with folks from these other parts of southern Mexico, they would likely actually switch into Spanish because it would be easier for them to understand each other speaking Spanish than because the Zapotecs are so different.
Okay. Wow.
So I've actually seen estimates up to 60 different versions of Zapotec, all of which are called Zapotec, at least when we're talking about them in English. So Zoque is part of the same language family, but it's when you think about the language family that Zapotec is part of, which is called Otomanguian, that language family, which includes both Zoque and Zapotec, for example, that's the equivalent of talking about the Indo-European family of languages, which includes everything from Hindi to Farsi to Arabic to English to Spanish. So, you know, the larger language family is enormous.
Okay. All right. Now, in looking at Zapotec in the poems that I looked at, just the written language has a lot of markings to it, apart from the letters, a lot of look like accent marks or some sort of guideline for, I don't know, pronunciation. What are those for?
So some of them are similar to the, you know, accents or what, you know, they call diacritical marks that you would see in French or Spanish,
right,
where it's telling you how to pronounce that vowel usually. But in addition to that, Zapotec, like a lot of Otomanguean languages, is tonal. So many of those marks are telling you what tone it is, and there are four major tones in Zapotec. So that has to be indicated, because that's something that you can't indicate in terms of the letter, mm-hmm, because there's four different tones. So a lot of the marks are telling you what tone it is. And I have to say that my knowledge of the tonal aspect of Zapotec is pretty much zero.
Okay.
I can hear the differences in the tones when people talk about it, but I don't even know, you know, what the different diacritical marks mean when I'm looking at the Zapotec version. You know, mostly what I'm looking for when I look at the Zapotec version of a poem before I translate it is end rhyme, and whether there's rhyme within the line, and then also I ask the poet to do just a straight translation into Spanish of the poem, which includes things like the word order in Zapotec is very different from Spanish. So often when they give me just a word by word translation from Zapotec into Spanish, it looks very different from the published Spanish version of the poem.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it does, because even between English and Spanish, there will be word order differences,
right,
just based on, you know, that the pronouns, they place their pronouns differently than we do, or
right,
whatever. Yeah.
Right.
No, you had mentioned before, you mentioned a few minutes ago, Irma Pineda. So I wonder if we can talk a little bit about how you came to know her and her work. I know that in something that I read, a neighbor of yours introduced you to her work. Is that right?
Yes, I lived in the part of Mexico that Irma is from and still lives, the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, for several years, mm-hmm, from 2000 to 2002. But I never met her at that time, and I had heard sort of vaguely about this large community of poets and other writers who lived in Juchitán and in the surrounding towns. And Juchitán was about an hour bus ride from where I was living. And the region where I was living was a completely different language, pretty different culture from Juchitán. So I went to Juchitán often, but I wasn't as immersed in that culture, so I never met Irma, although I had heard her name. And so years later, I'm living in Seattle. This was 2007, 2008, and I was working with a group of bilingual English-Spanish writers here from Mexico and from Chile, and we were putting together a multilingual literary series where we wanted to have each event have English, Spanish, and then one native language from the Americas. Mm-hmm. And so I found out from a friend of mine that he thought it would be great for us to include some poems by this poet, Irma Pineda, who was from his hometown. And one of the things that was really interesting was when I first met this neighbor and was chatting with him, his name is Jose Orozco, he couldn't really get over the fact that I knew his town, I had been to the village that he was from, which was outside of Juchitán, and had lived there and knew all of these local folks that he knew. He just couldn't get over that. So he was very excited to have me translate Irma's poems into English. He kept saying to me, but you know the culture so well and you lived there. And I kept saying to him, I don't speak one word of Zapotec. I really don't want to do this. And so eventually he convinced me to do it. And I did, I think, three or four poems for the actual event. And Irma was not able to come and present her own work, so we had someone there who spoke each of the three languages to present it. And the poems that he gave me to translate, even though I felt really unqualified to do so, I just loved the poems. And so I got in touch with her mostly to tell her that. And one of the things that she sent me in response was an essay that she had written about her own translation process. And in that essay, she talked about how she didn't think of what she was doing as translating a poem from Zapotec into Spanish. She thought of herself as recreating the poem, recreating a particular emotion or a particular moment in time or a particular feeling she had about something in one language and then recreating it in another language.
Right.
And that really helped me to think about the Spanish version of the poem as its own poem that was not entirely reliant on the original Zapotec version. And so then I went through a phase where I worked just from the Spanish versions and thought of them as their own originals.
Now, is that the same as her referring to her parallel poems or mirror poems?
The exactly.
Fact that, yeah, okay, yes. Yeah. That, I thought that was interesting, and I thought that would actually give someone more confidence in approaching translation because it takes the pressure off of recreating exactly what the original poet or author intended.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, you said a minute ago that one of the things the neighbor said to you that encouraged you to give this a try was that you knew the culture so well. And in reading a bit more about translation and about the poets that are creating work in this part of Mexico, the culture comes up so often, and just the fact that they are trying to preserve their culture, trying to communicate about their culture. And that does seem very relevant to his desire to have you be participant in this. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, that was pretty central to my getting started with translation in the first place. I am not a poet. I am not a fiction writer. I write only nonfiction. And I first started translating some short stories and some poems from the Isthmus of Tehuantepec in southern Mexico when I was still living there. Mm-hmm. And I never showed those translations to anyone. I didn't imagine I would ever do anything with them, but I did them as a way of getting a deeper understanding of the local culture beyond, you know, what I got from talking to people and interviewing people and following them around. And it was a really different sense. It gave me a very different sense of local culture in that there would be what seemed to me to be sort of historical or mythical references in these poems. Yeah. There were lines that just didn't really make sense to me. And so I would ask someone, you know, from that community, and they would say, oh, that's a reference to this story that we have about where our river came from. Or that's a reference we have to where the mountain that is at the edge of the village, you know, what its origin story was. And I came to realize when I was reading much later some of Irma Pineda's poems that every single line in some of her poems is a reference to a Zapotec story or origin story or bit of history. And so that also really cemented for me why she talks about her Spanish poem versions of her poems as mirror poems or parallel poems, because of course, even if they have the same ideas and images, they don't carry the same meaning.
Sure.
So when a Zapotec person reads the Zapotec version of the poem, that person is experiencing all these layers of his or her culture's history. And when a Spanish-speaking Mexican reads the Spanish version, they're experiencing some really lovely images and ideas and references, but not a whole culture or a whole history. And so I think when you are familiar with the culture that you're translating from, not just the language that you're translating from, sometimes you can fit a little bit of that in, not very often. But I think more often it's similar to when you very heavily research something for a nonfiction essay you're writing, and maybe 5% of your research ends up in your essay. And yeah. You might feel very disappointed, but at the same time, that essay has a heft and a richness that's just not there if you hadn't done the research.
Yes.
Or had only researched the pieces that you knew were going to go into your essay. And I think a similar thing happens. I am sometimes asked to translate work from Spanish that's from a country that I've never been to. Mm-hmm. And I always say no, because it seems bizarre to me that I only have one small portion of the background that I would need to do that.
Yeah, okay. So I wondered, apart from culture and all that informs your knowledge of the area, what guides your translation work? Would you say words, vowels and consonants, you know, the sensibility of emotion, things? I just thought maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. I wonder, because I've been asked this question before and I've seen other poets who are also translators answer it, if this is something that if I were a poet in my writing, not just in my translation work, if I would answer it differently, because I think I would have to say all of them, but in a varying order, depending yeah. on the work. So when I don't translate much prose anymore, but when I used to translate short stories, I would think first about plot and then about character development and then about what was happening on the sentence level. So I was sort of, you know, going from this outer circle to an inner circle with each mm-hmm. translation. And then I would think, you know, after those three levels, about the specific rhythm of each sentence and how to recreate that in some way. And I think I have a similar process with poetry, in that I think about the overall feeling that a poem gives me first, and what image do I, or feeling or image do I want to evoke when the reader reads it in English. And that helps me determine what kind of words to use. You know, there's a truism in translation that there are no true equivalencies between languages. That if you think about a word in English and that word's equivalent in Spanish, it's not an equal sign, it's sort of a Venn diagram, where maybe the meanings overlap by 90%, maybe they overlap by 20%. Right. And so depending on the other schema of meaning that's in a particular word, I would choose a word or not based on what the overall emotion or feeling is that I want the reader to be left with when they read the translation.
Yeah.
Eventually, when it's finished.
One example that I can think of from having read some of the translations is there's a poem called Your Suitcase, and there's the word, which was, I guess, originally in Zapotec, and then it was translated into Spanish, I assume by Irma Pineda, and she uses the word caminos, and putting it into English, the word became journey, which was interesting, because caminos to me means roads, which
right.
is different than journey, but is also a journey. And I loved just noticing that. It's kind of fun to know a little bit of two languages and read the translations and
right.
see how the poet
right.
made the choices.
Right, which is why I love, you know, bilingual editions of
yeah.
books of poetry and translation rather than just the translated version. And that's an interesting example you point out in that particular poem that I call Your Suitcase in English. The Spanish and Zapotec titles of that poem is actually The Suitcase.
Oh.
And I went back and forth about what to do with that, but I realized that when you live in a community where almost everyone has to migrate either temporarily or long-term for work, and almost everyone is only a slight exaggeration, even Irma Pineda, who makes a very fine living for herself as an educator. She teaches college in Juchitán. She lived in Mexico City for 10 years to get an education and to start her career.
Mm-hmm.
There, in a community where almost everyone migrates, the image of a suitcase is very personal. So
okay.
The suitcase would sort of be thought of in people's heads as my suitcase when I travel. Whereas I felt that that didn't necessarily come across in English. And so by making it Your Suitcase, it was clear that this was a very personal thing. And then that particular word, caminos, I had roads in there at one point. I had path in there at one point.
Uh-huh.
And I realized that the poem is really about the journey. So that's, you know, why I did that.
Yeah.
And in some cases, not in this case, but in some cases, the word that I chose in English is more based on kind of the universe of meaning of the Zapotec word. When I would ask her about, you know, what exactly does the Zapotec word mean if you had to describe it in a paragraph, and I would get something that was quite different than the word she had chosen in Spanish.
Yes. Is this a fun collaboration? Do the two of you enjoy sort of these conversations and figuring out how this should all... I mean, it almost sounds like you're translating everything together.
It is really fun. I mean, only occasionally do we get to do it together.
Okay.
One of the things that is really wonderful is that in addition to translating all of her own work into Spanish, and actually sometimes Irma will write a poem in Spanish and then translate it into Zapotec. She starts both ways. She began her publishing life translating Zapotec poems by other poets that had never appeared in Spanish into Spanish. So she really understands the translator's perspective, not just the writer's perspective.
Right.
And she's an incredible teacher. She's a very gifted teacher. So in going through a poem with her, I'm learning a lot about history, about culture, about these different references. She's also endlessly patient, which is really a gift to me. And so when we have the chance to actually do this together, it is really wonderful. And the other poets that I've whose work I've translated, I haven't, either because the person is no longer living or for other reasons, I haven't had the chance to do that. And I realize that I'm really lucky also to have someone who's not just available, but very open to having her work translated and very willing to let her work go. Because I know other translators that have worked with authors that really weren't able to give up the power that you have to give up in order to let someone essentially transform or destroy your work, depending on, you know, what your perspective is.
Right. Well, and it's great that she has this whole mirror idea, you know, and just sort of like, right. This is how it's reflecting to this person. This is how my work is reflecting.
Right.
It's really interesting. Okay, so Wendy, I want to talk a little bit about your National Parks Project. You started, I believe, in Vermont in 2011 with a residency at the Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historical Park. And it's the beginning of a big project that I think has continued since then. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how that started and what's happened so far.
Well, the roots of the National Park Project, which is what I call it for lack of a better term, actually began when I was living in Mexico and spending a lot of time with people who lived in what were biosphere reserves or what would, the equivalent would be national parks in the U.S., but the difference was there were whole communities that lived there within, you know, the wilderness area, and it was those communities that protected them from poachers, protected them from people, you know, shooting the animals and cutting down the trees, and they really were the conservation stewards of these places, these mm-hmm. wild places. And in the U.S., we have a very different conception where a national park is a place where no one lives and there are rangers who make sure that people don't hunt and cut down the trees. And so it's a very different perspective. But one of the things that people often talk to me about was Native people in the U.S. When I was living in Mexico, they would ask me about Native communities in the U.S. and how they had been dispossessed from their land. And so, although I knew some of that history, I didn't specifically know the history of our national parks and how directly most of them had been Native lands and how the first park rangers in the U.S. were soldiers who were hired to remove the Native communities from that land.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that these had been pristine places where no one lived was mostly invented. And so as I started to read more about that history in response to people asking me about it, that combined with what a lot of Mexican activists say when people like me come from the U.S., you know, wanting to help, you know, not help them, but sort of support their autonomy struggles, they'll say, well, you should also be doing your work at home. You know, your country has a lot of problems. You should go think about them more, which I think is very good advice.
Yeah.
So in a sense, I took that advice by looking into the history of my own country and thinking also about what a huge role the national parks had played in my childhood. I was a military kid. We moved all over. I've lived in all four corners of the continental U.S. And the one sort of constant in my childhood was always spending time in the national parks near where I lived, but being mostly ignorant of those parks' history and who had lived in the parks before. So I got interested in writing about that, not necessarily a book, but exploring those ideas. And the national park system in the U.S. has a really fantastic artist residency program. There are something around 45 national park units that have residency programs. And so the Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historic Park in Vermont was the first park that I applied to and was accepted for a residency.
And that's so in Woods. Is that in Woodstock? That's
it's in Woodstock, yes. It's a tiny little park. It's about the same size as the largest urban park in Seattle. So I think of it as being very small. But it's a lovely space. And the stewards there, the park staff there, are really just an incredible group of people. And they gave me all kinds of access to the history of the park. I talked to a lot of people that were part of the founding of the park. It's a fairly new park. It's less than 20 years old. And they also got me started thinking about some of the issues that I've continued to work with in this project related to our conception of home, what is the human relationship to the landscape. And so since then, I've done residencies at four other parks, one in each corner of the continental U.S. And it's been really interesting to see sort of what is similar about different parks and then how each park is very different in response to the local landscape. And then each park also has a fairly distinct relationship to the Native communities that either once lived in what is now the park or have always lived nearby.
Right. And now I would think that in this area in Vermont, you'd be talking about the Abnaki population.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, you know, I mean, in that little park, was the Abnaki population a resident at some point of that park?
Certainly, people spent a lot of time there. And one of the stories that I think is likely true, although hasn't been completely confirmed by archaeological evidence, was that what is now a tennis court at this park, that it was an estate, it was a Rockefeller estate that became a park, and where they put their tennis court was, as one of the staff there put it, the cultural hotspot of what is now that park. That's where people, you know, had their camps in the summer. That's where they worked. And so one thing that was interesting to me was that I first heard a ranger talk about the Abenaki people when I would go on the walks with all of the different rangers to see how they represented what their stories were of the same place. Mm-hmm. And the first person to mention anyone before white settlers came was a British ranger. I mean, she was naturalized U.S. citizen, but had grown up in the U.K. And I asked her about that, and she said, well, you know, I think it's easier for me to talk about that because it's not my personal history. Yeah. And she was the only one of the rangers there that always spoke about, you know, pre-European settlement in history in what had become this park.
Now, you mentioned that in Mexico people live in these places and that in this country it's different than that, but was there any sort of population of locals or visitors? Was it a very solitary experience being in these various parks? And I do mean all of the four parks, or five. Was it four or
it was five
parks?
It was five, yes. Yeah. It was a park in Vermont, and then Acadia in Maine, the Everglades in Florida, Joshua Tree in California, and the North Cascades in Washington.
Oh, wow. Great. So how solitary were you in most of these situations?
It was different in each park, and I was there during what's considered the visitor high season for all four of the parks. And so there were a lot of people around. In some cases, I was living, you know, near where kind of the central visitation area was and spent a lot of time in the visitor center. In other parks, I was farther away from that. And then also the way people use different parks is very different. You know, when people go to the Everglades, very few people actually get in a boat and go out into the more wilderness parts of the Everglades. They tend to stay on the one road. There's one road that goes through, you know, the Everglades.
Right.
And they tend to stay pretty close to their cars. So there, I saw many, many people every day. I actually didn't have a car there. I had a bike, which limited how far I could go. But I would go to some of the more visited parts. In the North Cascades, people, again, a lot of people don't go very far from their cars. But most people that go to the North Cascades are there to go backpacking and to be, you know, hiking out where they're not going to see other people. And I was staying in a cabin that was very close to where visitors arrived at the park. But if I, you know, hiked out a mile or two, I could spend a whole day hiking and not see another person.
Okay. All right.
And then in Acadia, there were traffic jams everywhere because Acadia is very small and very busy.
Yeah. Okay. well, if you're there in the high season, too, that's going to make more sense. I'm sure that Acadia is pretty quiet parts of the year. So.
Right.
Yeah. So now, did you get your funding for each park separately, or how did that work for you?
It was different for each park, and different. One of the things that's interesting about the National Park Service residencies is that each park manages their own project. Some of them, they give you a place to live. Some of them, they give you a place to live and a stipend to cover your other expenses. It really varies. I also was able to get some support from both the City of Seattle, with the Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs here, and then King County, which is the county that Seattle is a part of, has an Arts and Culture Commission that funded part of that work. You know, I did all kinds of things. I used a lot of frequent flyer miles from other people. One of the things that's nice about spending time in a park is that it's really cheap. There's not really anything to spend money on.
Right.
So if you have a place to live and you have a place to cook food, it's actually not any more expensive than being at home.
Yeah, right.
And maybe cheaper because there are no stores.
Now, are you finished? Are the five parks going to be the total?
I'm finished with sort of the experiential part of it and the residencies in the parks. I'm very much at the early stages in figuring out what this all means. One of the things I've been thinking about a lot is indigenous literary forms, not in the sense of related to Native communities, but in the sense of, are there particular literary forms that grew out of particular landscapes or have affinities to particular landscapes? Because one of the things I found as I was starting to write about different parks was that the form that my writing was taking, even though it's all nonfiction prose, was very different depending on I think, the landscape of the place. So, for example, the first park I was at in Vermont, which is a very small park, less than 500 acres, I wrote little micro essays. You know, I wrote these little essays that were maybe 300 words long, and I had never done that before. And then when I was in the Everglades, which is very, very flat, especially if you are a person who lives in Seattle, it seems fabulously flat. It's not quite flat, of course, because that's why the water has a flow toward the ocean and toward Florida Bay. But I remember the first time I visited the Everglades seeing a sign that said, Pine Forest, elevation 4 feet. And I just thought that was hysterically funny. But then I realized that in the Everglades, elevation 4 feet is a completely different ecology than elevation 2 feet.
Right.
And so those differences are really significant. Mm-hmm. And there, the first piece that I wrote after I was at the Everglades, which was actually for an exhibition that they were doing in South Florida of people that had written and produced work related to the Everglades, I was writing American sentences, which is sort of, it's been considered the American haiku by the Beat poets in that it's a 17-syllable line. So it's essentially taking our interpretation of the Japanese haiku form and putting it all in one sentence.
Okay.
So I had never written an American sentence before. I had read Allen Ginsberg's and read other writers' American sentences, but suddenly that's all I was writing about the Everglades, and I think it's because it's flat and stretched out.
Oh, that's great. I like that. Do you know the poet Jody Gladding? I'm just curious.
I do not.
Oh, okay. So she's a Vermont poet. And she integrates her poetry and the natural world, but it's in a very different way. It's not what you're talking about. It's not where the form sort of imitates the natural world. It's more like she's actually bringing artifacts from the natural world, sticks and feathers and things, into her poetry somehow. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
So is it displayed visually then?
It's displayed visually. Sometimes it's also used in her readings. I think that sometimes she has ways of making sounds with these pieces, you know, that are part of the poems. So it's kind of cool.
Oh, I'm definitely going to have to look her up.
Yes.
The piece that I'm working on right now, which is about the North Cascades, is going to be an audio essay, because one of the things that really struck me in the North Cascades was that you are always within earshot of running water, because there's running water everywhere, and the soundscape is always filled with birds, no matter what time of day it is, no matter where you are. And so I realized that to me, the North Cascades is an audio experience, not a print experience.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit before we move on. I want to talk a little bit about your experience of Hurricane Irene. When you were staying in the park in Vermont, Irene struck. So I wanted to just hear the story of what happened to you and how you reacted to this.
Well, I had been in the park for, about 4 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks, when Hurricane Irene struck, and as it happened, there were 2 weeks of my 8-week residency in Vermont where my goddaughter, who is 4 years old, or at the time was 4 years old, was with me. And so my partner had flown out to Seattle and brought her to visit. I had her for 2 weeks, and then I was going to be taking her back to Seattle. And it was in the last few days of her visit that we were sent home early from the park. The park was closing early because we needed to prepare for a big windstorm. That's what we were told. And I was renting a lovely duplex that was in the south end of Woodstock, which is historically was the more working class and African-American community lived there. And the building that I was living in was about 150 years old. It was a small house that had been made into a duplex on a very steep hillside.
Okay.
And so I went home with my 4-year-old goddaughter, and we tied down everything outside that we thought might blow away. And then there was almost no wind, but there was a huge amount of rain. And across the street from us, several hundred yards away, was a little tiny creek that was maybe 10 feet wide. And as the rain continued through the night, you know, into the next morning, at one point my goddaughter was standing at the big window that looked out over the front yard hill and then down to this creek. And she said, "Oh, look, Wendy, the golf course is turning into a swimming pool." And between the creek and us was a golf course that was, in fact, filling with water as this creek became probably in the end about 500 feet wide, and just kept rising and rising. And then my goddaughter turned and she said, "Oh, look, Wendy, a waterfall." And it was because the road in front of our house had collapsed. And so all of this water that was rushing down the hillside was being engulfed in this enormous hole. It was probably 20 feet in diameter and at least 15 feet deep. It just collapsed. And then I thought, well, is my house going to collapse? And I didn't know where I would go if we left, because what I had been hearing, and actually I was hearing this just from the internet, because we had internet service still, but the phones had gone out, was that things were worse in other parts of Woodstock. And people's homes were flooding, and I thought, well, we're pretty high up the hill. This house has been on this hillside for 150 years. I think I'm just going to wait it out, which is what we did. So we filled the bathtub with water, thinking maybe the water will go out, and kind of prepared for not having any power. And we lost power for 2 days. We didn't have water for 10 days. But the thing that was interesting to me was that on the wealthier side of town in Woodstock, the Rockefeller family had paid to have all of the electrical cable buried when they lived in what was now the park as one of their summer-winter homes, because they didn't want to look at the electrical cable. On my side of town, where I was staying, they had not buried the electrical cable. And so we only lost power for a day and a half. The rest of Woodstock lost power for 8 to 10 days because all of the cable had been buried.
Yeah.
And then it just so happened that 2 days later was the time for me to drive to Hanover, New Hampshire, and take my goddaughter back to Seattle. And I was able to leave on the only road that was open at that time. And I was able to rent pretty much the last rental car, I think, in, you know, the Green Mountain area of Vermont. I got her to the airport. We flew home. I had one day in Seattle. I flew back. And by the time I got back, you know, Woodstock and I think all of the other communities affected had just completely reorganized itself into an incredibly well-run sort of refugee camp. You know, people were bringing all of their food that was defrosting in their refrigerator and having community dinners on the village green every night. And they were delivering water to people's houses. And I was – this all happened during, you know, the 48 hours that I was away. And it was really quite incredible to see.
That is, that's such an endorsement of their preparedness. I mean, because it was so hard on so many communities here, and I think, you know, a lot of people were leaving from areas that hadn't been affected to go and help out in areas that had been affected. I think that it, you know, people pulled together rather well, but so did you participate? Were you able to dig in and help, or how did it go for you after that?
Well, the thing that was interesting is that I think because I was a guest in the park, you know, the park staff kept saying, "Oh, no, no, you're just here to write. Just do your work. Don't worry, don't worry, don't worry." And then, as you say, people had come from all over to help. And so I was away the first 2 days of the kind of post-disaster project. And so by the time I got back, there were volunteers everywhere. People were digging mud out of people's houses. You know, it was this real incredible operation that I actually didn't have the opportunity to be part of, other than to walk around and talk to people about their experiences and write them down.
Which is important. Somebody has to bear witness.
Yeah, but it was – and then later the thing that was interesting to me was then into the fall, I was going around to different bookstores in Vermont. I had a book that had just come out that summer, and so I was going around and doing bookstore events and seeing how there were some communities in Vermont that had not, you know, had the kind of recovery support that Woodstock did. And even after pretty much all of the buildings at Woodstock had been cleaned out and everybody was back home and the city was or the town was operating again, you could go to other, you know, less well-off communities in Vermont, and it was as if the storm had just happened.
Yeah.
And they were so cut off by the roads being out that I think it was very hard for help to get there because there wasn't any way to get there.
Right. Yeah. I think another thing that happened was that the rivers actually moved, you know, and so people's properties or houses were just sort of swept away, which I guess in areas that experience these sorts of problems more frequently than we do, it's not a surprise, but I think Vermont was taken very unawares.
Oh, so. Yes. At least in Woodstock, you know, we were very, very much surprised. And I was joking that when I was in college, my family lived in New Orleans. I had just been living the last couple of years before that, mostly in Miami. And so I lived in these areas where you prepare for hurricanes.
Right.
And there was never a hurricane in the time I lived in New Orleans or Miami. And then I came to Vermont and there was a hurricane.
Was that your first experience of being in Vermont sort of as a semi-resident? I know that now you have a regular experience of working at Goddard College. So had you had much experience with Vermont before the park?
That was the longest period of time I'd spent in Vermont. I lived in Boston for a decade. And several of those years, I was on the board of an organization that no longer exists that used to be based in Burlington called Action for Social and Ecological Justice.
Okay.
And so I would go, you know, every couple of months, I would go to Vermont for board meetings. I would go to Burlington pretty regularly to do trainings with the staff, you know, as a board member. But that was the first time I had actually lived in Vermont. And of course, people in Boston think of Vermont as heaven, I think, the way that people in New York do. And so I always had this very idealized vision of what Vermont was like. You know, Vermont was where I went for the weekends to kind of recover from the stress of living in the city.
Yeah, yeah. So when did you get involved at Goddard College?
That was a year and a half ago. I was hired to teach in the Bachelor of Fine Arts in Creative Writing. And the program at Goddard is, I know this word is overused, but it is actually true in this case. It is unique in that it is the only low residency BFA in writing in the country, meaning
okay.
that these are undergraduate students. They go to Goddard for 8 days at the beginning of each semester, do a very intensive residency. They put together their own curriculum for the semester. They choose their books. They decide what genres they're going to focus on. They decide the order in which they're going to do their work. And then they go home and work with faculty mentors one-on-one. And
okay.
so I was hired in part to work with the students in the program, and then the other part of my job was to start a literary journal with the students so that they could actually learn that whole side of the literary and publishing world.
And that's Duende.
Yes.
And before we move on, I just want to ask, Goddard also has a low residency MFA program, is that correct?
It does. It actually has 8 different low residency programs. The college operates completely on the low residency model,
okay.
and it's had low residency programs since the 60s. And the MFA program is, there's one based in Vermont, and then there's actually also an MFA in creative writing that's in Port Townsend, not far from here in Seattle.
Okay. All right. And do you also participate in that program, or are you mostly based in
Vermont?
No,
it's a separate faculty. Sometimes faculty move back and forth, but mostly people stick with their home program, and mine is the BFA program in Vermont.
Okay. All right. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Duende. So the title, how did the title get chosen?
It now seems like a very obvious title for a literary journal, but it did not happen that way. My students... And the way that the project works is that we had 3 semesters from the day that I started at Goddard until we had to produce our first issue, which
mm-hmm.
when I was hired seemed like an eternity. I thought, what are we going to do for 18 months? And then it came to seem like a luxury, and then it came to seem like a necessity. And the first issue launched on October 1st, so very recently, October 1st, 2014. And so... We did a lot of things before we chose a name. We talked about aesthetics. We talked about what genres did we want to publish. The only kind of criterion when I started was this must be a digital-only journal. This is for students to learn about online and digital publishing opportunities and systems.
Yeah.
And so one of the first things I did was kind of assuage the students' fear that an online journal doesn't mean anything, that they needed to have print. And so we talked a lot about digital distribution and how a readership is different when anyone can access you anywhere in the world, you know, where there are English-speaking people, versus a print document that you then have to figure out how to get out to people.
Yeah, yeah.
And they went through many, many names. It was about 6 months in when we started talking about names because I wanted them to have a strong sense of a vision of what specifically they wanted the literary journal to accomplish before they started thinking about names. And the thing that's interesting is they did a brainstorm. All of the students in the BFA program and other folks at Goddard participated in that. We asked people to send in names, and we ended up with no names that we wanted. And so what ended up happening was we had a list of finalist names, none of which we really liked. We all left residency, went home, sad that we didn't have a name yet. And then one of the students who is currently the design editor for the journal, Cameron Price, he says he was sitting at breakfast one day and he decided that Duende should be our name. This word just came to him. Now, he says that he did not know at that time what Duende meant or how it was associated with, you know, the history of poetry in Spain and now increasingly in the U.S. And so he sent me, he Googled the word and found out about Federico Lorca and found out about, you know, his 1933 lecture speech about the spirit of Duende and its importance in art. And then he realized this is the name we should have. And some people, when Cameron tells this story, don't believe him because it seems like such an act of Duende. But I also know Cameron to be one of the most honest people I've ever met. So I do believe him that the word just came to him over breakfast.
Now, for people who do not know, Duende is sort of, it's like about emotion. It has to do with the soul and emotion. Can you just describe how you would describe it for...
Sure. It's a very complicated word. It's a perfect example of that truism that we were talking about earlier, that there are no equivalencies between languages. So technically, a duende, in the way that I first learned the word when I was learning Spanish, was that it was a small gnomish spirit creature who may be have physical form and may be really just a spirit who lives in the woods.
Yeah.
Because I have a name that sounds very much like duende and rhymes with duende, at least when you're saying it in Spanish. And I'm very short. People often made fun of me when I was living in Mexico about, oh, Duende the Duende. like I was a little creature who lived in the woods. Now, the way that Federico Lorca, who was a Spanish poet and playwright, was speaking about the spirit of Duende was in a much more metaphorical sense.
Right.
That art was not about struggle, that art was not about ideas, that art was about this spiritual sort of transcendence that you had when you were really in the moment of creating or experiencing the art, whatever that art form was.
And this student feels that it's so funny. He must have just picked up on it without picking up on it.
Right.
And, he must have heard it used somewhere and not really thought about it.
Exactly. And he's a really wonderful poet and has read really widely for an undergraduate. You know, he came to Goddard having already really spent a lot of energy reading about poetry. And so I'm sure that he had read about it in the past and then forgot about it. And then that, you know, idea rose from his subconscious at the ideal moment while he was eating breakfast.
That's great. How many of the students are actively involved with the journal? Does every student in the BFA program have to participate in some way, or how does that work?
Not every student. It ends up, I would say, you know, over the three or four or five semesters that a student is in the BFA program, because usually students come to us already with an associate's in fine arts or a couple of years of college credit, you know, that they've done somewhere else. Right. So usually students are with us for three or four semesters. I would say most students end up spending at least one semester with the journal. Some come and are part of the Duende staff their entire time at Goddard. And right now we have 12 students that mm-hmm. are part of creating it. And the genres that we accept and publish are poetry, prose, both fiction and nonfiction, hybrid work, meaning something that's sort of between genre lines. And then we're also very interested in collaborations, either multiple writers working on a piece or writers collaborating with visual artists. And then we also publish visual art separate from collaborations.
Okay. And who can submit?
Anyone who works in English or translates into English or creates visual art and has enough command of English that they can read our website and figure out how to submit via Submittable. Our first issue, we had people from 14 different states. They ranged in age from 16 to early 70s.
Okay.
And we also had poets from the UK and from Peru who were published in our first issue.
Wonderful. And is there any description of aesthetic that you would use to describe what you look for in submissions?
You know, there There is. It's like Duende, it's very hard to put into words.
Right.
But one of the things that the students really talked about is that they like work that tastes good on the tongue. They like work that's slightly off kilter. Another thing that is really part of the mission of Duende, which is something the students came up with on their own during our second semester of working toward our first issue, was that they really wanted a literary journal that focused on presenting work by writers and artists who were underrepresented. One of the things the students noticed as we were reading through many, many, many online and print literary journals to figure out what we wanted Duende to look like was that people of color, older people, teenagers, that there were many groups of people that really seemed underrepresented. And I remember several students saying, well, you know, a lot of these journals are just publishing the same people, and it all the work sort of sounds the same. And so they decided that that would be part of our mission. And so the way that that's worded in our mission statement is that Duende aspires to represent the true beauty and diversity of the U.S. literary ecosystem. And in the first issue, the students did an amazing job of then going out and recruiting work from those communities. And so in the first issue, I think almost three-quarters of the work that we published was by writers and artists of color, which is fairly unusual, unless it's a magazine that is limited, you know, to folks from a particular community.
Right. Okay.
And so, you know, we had that ranged from, you know, African-American writers in California to Appalachian writers in Appalachia. I mean, it was a really big range of people that were published. And one thing that was interesting to me was that even with this really wide diversity, there is a really specific aesthetic to the magazine in that the students got to the point where they could really quickly read a piece and say, okay, this is a piece for Duende or this isn't. And one of the things that meant was that they were willing to do a lot of editorial back and forth with some of the writers if they really felt that that writer was somebody that they wanted included. And so I think, you know, the terminology that the students were using, you know, something that tastes good on the tongue, something that's slightly off kilter, really sort of represented what we published. A lot of people referred to it as surprising, but also surprisingly enjoyable, the experience of reading it.
Well, that's great, and that is unique and a little bit different, and helps people figure out. Like, I mean, you always are told to read the journal before you submit, but with such a new journal, it's kind of helpful to have a little bit more to go on before deciding whether or not to send something in.
And I have to say, as a writer and as a submitter of my work over many years, I know that that's the best advice a journal can give, but it's also, at least in my experience, fairly useless in that I read a journal and I know whether I like it or not, but I have a very hard time thinking my work would fit in here or my work wouldn't fit in here.
Right.
And when I think about the pieces I've sent out and where they've been accepted, I actually have found the choices to be somewhat baffling. So
yeah, right.
I definitely understand, you know, writers being frustrated by that advice and feeling that they don't know where to submit their work.
It's so true. You know, you can read a piece and go like, well, okay, so this has a child narrator and I have a story with a child narrator.
Right.
That's really not it.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, subtler.
I thought about this even more when I started submitting my translations for publication, because one of the real differences for me in works that I write and works that I translate is that I feel like I have much more emotional clarity and distance from the work that I translate. You know, to start with, the only things I translate are things that I love and I want to share with people who don't read Spanish.
Right.
And so I already feel very strongly about the piece. I can defend the piece. And then I'll think, oh, you know, this poem by Irma Pineda would just be perfect for this journal, and I will send it, and it will not be the poem that they accept.
Hmm.
You know, the poem of hers that is my absolute favorite poem of, I guess I've translated maybe 50 or 60 of her poems. That poem has yet to be published, even though more than half of the other poems I've translated have been published. It's been rejected by so many journals, but I'm convinced that this is her best poem of the, you know, 50 or 60 that I have English versions of.
Yeah, and I think that's such a good thing for people to hear, though, because I think it's just so subjective and so personal, the taste of an editor and what they're going to gravitate towards. And I think it's really helpful to get that message and to realize it is not personal. I mean, exactly. It's their personal taste, but it's not personal against the writer. And that can be so hard to process when you've got, you know, these mounting rejection slips.
Right.
Just, yeah. Well, Wendy, I want to thank you so much. This was fantastic. We covered a lot of ground.
So, yes.
I really enjoyed our conversation. I wanted to say my guest was Wendy Call. I interviewed her once before about her book, No Word for Welcome, The Mexican Village Faces the Global Economy, which won the 2011 National Book Prize for Nonfiction from Grub Street, which is great. Wendy, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much, Shayla. It's been so fantastic to move from translation in Mexico to national parks in the U.S. To Lorca's Duende.
That's great.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Wendy Call. You can learn more about her work at her very informative website, wendycall.com. You can hear a previous interview with Wendy Call from September 2011 at the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to choose one of the following sentences and translate it into a language of your own design. Here are the sentences. Tomorrow morning, as the sun shines up and over the eastern wall of your house, you will awaken to a gift of joy. He ran through the woods and hopped the stones in a bright cold stream, shouting that he had won. Alone, without purpose or thought, she brings a hand to her face and feels the cool touch of her own comfort. I'll put those sentences on the podcast site as well. So pick one and translate it into a language of your own invention. Make up sounds that feel like these sounds. Shape them into words. See what other sentences come out of your unusual translation into an unknown language. Try to create a sense of the sentence that another reader might come close to understanding, if not intellectually. It might be nonsense, but it might feel just right, too. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors, if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com. And that's where you can get all the archived episodes. New and recent episodes of Write the Book are also available wherever you get your podcasts, so you can just subscribe to have them sent to your podcast app. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week, so be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. You can also access the podcast and link to our social media presence at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it and talk about it with people who might enjoy it. Up next at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well, and have a great week.